Hello, Ears on Art fans. Please join us for part two of an interview conducted in June of 2002.
While most artists struggle to confiscate whatever space they can to form a studio, we converse with two artists with the luxury of five dedicated spaces within their home. I'm Stephen DeLuque, and this is Ears on Art, a show devoted to the visual arts. Krissa Hewitt and I continue our conversation with sculptors Bozzo and Margaret Coroscelli as they share their love of process and the melding of their disciplines to make a creative and artistic lifestyle. Join us now in Bozzo's marble carving studio.
Is there a chance to see some action going on here with a child
Let's
on
make
your back?
Noise.
A little chiseling, Bozzo?
Chiseling here, and I could pass her off to him after he's done with that.
Okay.
This hammer here, I use to do a large sculpture in Europe. You have certain kind of an angle you have to hit the, and then you get this kind of an effect. It's like steps, and. You smell it now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When you're hitting with this hammer, the intent is not to necessarily remove lots of material, but
no.
more a chipping kind of action?
You develop kind of a, you anticipate certain things, so just like if you play violin or cello, you anticipate the next pitch by the finger, you know, to place it. So after you get familiar with the density, then you anticipate certain kind of results. In certain strokes, it grows into you. It literally grows into you.
And that's years of experience and working with the stone and the hammer. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
This looks like a medieval weapon here. This one here, for instance.
That is the biggest meat tenderizer I've ever seen.
And try to lift it. And then,
oh, my.
How many pounds?
Oh, it's at least... Six, seven.
Yeah,
pounds.
I guess about 7 pounds.
8 pounds.
Yeah.
That gives you
watch your toes.
I'm sure there's some effects that give you.
We're saying meat tenderizer because the end of the hammer has very much that look of a meat tenderizer.
And that gives too much, but see the dots here appearing. I have accumulated all the, and I inherited some from my teacher too. Chisels, and they're not cheap.
No, they're not cheap, and what I've found is that they don't make them like they used to. There's
That's
something
very
about
true.
A tool that has been used with love for many years that is just very special, a different experience.
Totally. All this is going to stay the rest of my life, the ones I inherited.
What is this black type of stone? Is this type of granite?
Conglomerate. It's called conglomerate. The fusion of all sorts of elements. Not too hard, really. Interesting.
Is it harder to carve in the sense that it doesn't just sort of come off in predictable ways? Or how does it differ from cutting the white marble?
Well, most of the stones I deal with they're behaving themselves. this one here, I was very frustrated because it was dynamited, and then here... I can tell that part is going to go.
Do you find that the dynamiting process actually destabilizes the stone slightly?
Very much, yeah.
Does it?
You know, sometimes, you know, even when you chisel the stone, the way I learned it, you send the vibration slowly before you go the final blow for a larger chunk. You go, and then that molecules transfer the vibration, if there is any fault there at all, and goes.
Yes.
I lost some big piece here. The diabase, limestone, and granite, and marble, of course. Those are the ones I stick to it. Staying away from a serpentine because of the asbestos. Now, this is called serpentine, too, black serpentine, but there is no asbestos in there.
Is serpentine brittle? I've heard from other sculptors that it tends to be brittle.
And they are the ones who really carry the asbestos, too. In old country, we call the diabase. It runs in Alps too. Beautiful stone, really. Like that's Diabas, the Prometheus here. Works very well. Very well.
You've mentioned old country. Where were you born?
Republic of Georgia. having problems now and then.
They certainly are. You said you had inherited a lot of your tools, and from whom did you inherit them?
George Papashvili is a sculptor. He's known in back east much more. On in Ibach, we used to admire him, and he had some studio here in Cambria, and we met accidentally. And
one of his pieces is outside the San Luis Obispo Art Center.
That's right. One of them is there, and it's a very sensitive sculptor.
You have some public art pieces. I know there's one in Morro Bay.
Two of them in Morro Bay.
Where exactly are they?
One in front of the library and one in waterfront. Stone is alive. It's there.
Margaret was making a reference to just the physical, you know, sort of difficulty in some ways of being the sculptor, the weight of whatever. How do you find that works? Obviously, you can't just sort of flip the piece of marble around and look at it in 10 different directions. What do you do?
Well, it keeps me in shape. I don't have time to get old. I don't have a chance to get old. Yeah, we had the show in Colorado, and we had heavy, heavy stuff. We barely made over the continental pass. And I had to do all by hand. But it keeps in shape.
I've heard, I think the figure was that about a cubic foot of marble is usually about 180 pounds or so. Is that approximately?
Yeah, that's pretty close. Yeah.
Always seems like 300 when I'm trying to look at it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So did you get some stone noises?
Yeah, we have some stone noises.
Would you like to come over to the metal shop if you like?
Sure.
I'll pass this little
one over to Margaret's side of the studio.
The one thing about sharing a studio with a stone sculptor is all of my stuff is constantly coated with stone dust. It takes about 5 seconds. So this is where I would do my cutting and welding. And then I just brought a few other pieces down here to show you. These are some of the bronzes that I worked on not too long ago. This year, or maybe from a half a year ago, from last fall. And I don't know, one of the things you can see, I told you that I've really changed my scale.
Mm-hmm. These are hand-holdable as compared to 6 and 8 feet tall.
So. Exactly. And one of the things is that then as I'm working with new imagery, I can work more quickly. It's not like making something that's 8 feet tall and deciding that I didn't like that image after all. And then also I'm just working with more intimate imagery. These are some images dealing with women who, because of social circumstances, have been forced to abandon their children. And I just, for me, they wouldn't be appropriate in, you know, a huge scale. So I like this kind of intimate feeling that I can get working with the very small waxes and then turning them into bronze, which, you know, we always associate more of a precious quality with bronze than we do with steel. Mm-hmm. And so I like that sense.
Sometimes I've come across people who have a real issue about scale with sculpture, deciding that if anything's smaller than 2 or 3 feet in any direction, that it's not sculpture. This doesn't appear that you quite think that way. Do you have any thoughts on what constitutes sculpture?
Well, for me, it's always tied into content. Even if I'm not dealing with something that is immediately recognizable as an image or a subject, all of my work always has content. And so scale is just one more factor to consider, just like the material, the media would be another thing that I would pick something that needs to say what I want to say.
Talk to me a little bit about the notion of content. That's another phrase that gets put out there as though perhaps we all know exactly what that phrase means.
Well, for me, when I say content, it has to do with some sort of a meaning or message that's in the work. And sometimes that can be very explicit in a work that's narrative, that actually tells a story. But in my work, it's more implied. There's always some sort of imagery I'm working with. Sometimes I'm not even exactly sure what it is because I'm working very intuitively. And yet I always have some idea of, you know, the general direction it's going, what I'm trying to say. And as I said before, I'm always working from my inner sensibility, how I make sense of the world.
How do you help a student find that message? What sort of assignments do you give that, especially as they're just beginning and trying to figure out how to technically deal with material, how do you get them involved with the content part as well?
Well, I vary it. Some of my sculpture assignments are more content-based, and then others are more just dealing with form. But sometimes, you know, again, form and content for me are inseparable. And so even if I give them an assignment where they have to work asymmetrically, it turns into an assignment about content, because that is like one of the most difficult things.
Pulling teeth, that's exactly what I know.
And you would think, it's very simple, and yet as human beings, we have such a natural desire to go back to being balanced, harmonious, all of that. And there's a place for that kind of sculpture also, but I want to teach them that there's a, you know, again, it's a conscious choice. And obviously, asymmetry to me is much more engaging. It engages the mind oftentimes much more.
Well, if you and I keep this up forever, we might convince a few people.
That's what I find. I know that as soon as they leave my class, they're probably going right back and doing, you know, one-sided symmetrical things, but that's okay too. But I don't really think so. And then the other thing is sometimes I really make them work an idea. An assignment that they just finished, they had to research ancient votive figures and then create one of their own votive figures. And we tend to think of votive figures as being religious, and I, you know, said it doesn't have to be a religious content. It can be about, you know, some individual that you know. It can be a hobby that you have, a political statement, something about gender roles, you know, any kind of content. And then that gives something very specific. Then we can talk about, well, if you paint your sculpture red, that's obviously going to say something very different than if you paint it blue, or if you use jagged lines or smooth lines. And then we can talk about the form more specifically. So I always, with my assignments, I try to have maybe, you know, 3 to 4 objectives that they have to meet just to pass the assignment, and then they have to put something of themselves in it to make it really a...
Another three or four of their own,
exactly. So that, you know, I always like to look over a semester's work and see as many solutions to the problem as there are students in the class. I don't want them, obviously, to make little Margaret Coricelli sculptures. And then, you know, I told you before how I just often like to use humor in my work. I like to have that sense of balance between something that's very serious. So at the same time I was making these works that I consider much more serious, for some reason this odd little chicken form just decided it needed to emerge.
It's funny you say that, because I've just done a series of 17 paintings of chickens, and I have no concept of where they came from. It's like
we have 2 chickens, they're in the back, and so I'm sure part of it was related to just being around these interesting birds.
So I'm gonna fire up the torch here,
and I'm not exactly sure how interesting this will be on the radio, but we'll give it a shot.
Adjusting down actually to a very tiny kind of flame, but a very hot one.
Right. That's called a neutral flame, and that means that there are equal parts of the acetylene and the oxygen. And if you can just see how I adjust the tip, if I'm trying to get rid of that middle area there, and when I just bring it into focus, it's almost like adjusting a camera, then I know that it's ready to start cutting. So I'm going to come over here, and this is just a piece that I'm thinking I may use as a wheel for another piece. So I put the torch on the edge of the metal to preheat it, and you might want to watch your feet. You do have closed-toed shoes. Okay, good. I should have told you that was a requirement of ours.
Something already fell off, so made it past one of the curves.
Making a 180 turn from Margaret's metal cutting area, we find ourselves facing another of the Coricelli studios.
This is where I repair the furniture. Speaking of happiness, homemade furniture is appreciated a lot more. Yes.
So this is actually the woodworking studio.
Yeah.
This is our other wood carving area. That's more his area there. This is my area back here. And then just bandsaw, table saw.
All of the standard household items.
I think that's part that a lot of the public does not understand, is the monetary investment required to go into oftentimes these types of disciplines and artistic expression. And it's quite a bit of an investment.
That's true. And the space.
Well, yes,
you need to have space
itself
to store the work and the materials. And again, I good-naturedly complained about the dust on my welding stuff, but if I was a painter, I wouldn't be good-naturedly complaining about having all of this dust on my painting. So,
it's texture.
Most the painters don't want to share a studio with sculptors. I think Leah would like to show you the treehouse.
Let's see your treehouse. That is something.
Whoa.
My goodness. Okay, I never had one of these to play with.
So do you swing on some of these ropes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's the second floor up there.
So you and your dad built this?
Mm-hmm.
Did you help design it?
Not really.
But you cheered him on when he was building it?
Mm-hmm.
He said,
have you ever collaborated on a sculpture?
Not directly. We've collaborated on shows before.
Right. And so we, okay.
But I don't. Have we ever collaborated on an actual sculpture? I've worked with him on sculptures, mm-hmm. but again, it was more. It wasn't a true collaboration. I was actually. It was his sculpture, and I.
And you
was
were
just,
the assistant.
And I was the assistant,
right.
and just having fun working on it. Whereas, in terms of planning something from the beginning, again, temperamentally, our styles are so different. Uh-huh. I can't imagine, but that might be something to think about.
But. Metal and marble are not impossible to think about. I mean, people do combine those.
We have, combined the two. But again, that was more in my work.
Mm-hmm. So it's more a factor of style, perhaps, than materials in this case.
And maybe a little control issue.
Oh, that.
We need one to drill a hole through the stone, and then when they had the mobile for that, we did together. I have to check her memory here. And there.
Oh, there's one other studio we haven't been to yet, and that's the music studio.
That's the music studio.
And it's such an important part of the life. I think we need to see that. Bye, chickens.
It's the music studio here.
Did you build it?
Yeah.
Did you build the house?
Yes. It was just a little cabin in the night. We went on and on.
It's not a little cabin anymore.
No. But I built this music. That was my dream to do it someday. And that turned out to be very excellent acoustic. And musicians would love to play here. And we have some chamber concerts here. People sit here.
Uh-huh. And then you open up the windows?
Is yeah, they all open up.
But it is also possible to record in there? Is it?
I don't like to record. It's a house concert, and it's very, very organic. No publicity, no money, no politics. Come, and musicians invite their own guests, and we have some 200 people here sitting mm-hmm. here inside.
It's a very intimate space.
Very.
Have you ever made an instrument?
Yeah, I made a harpsichord one.
Is not the room that's full of marble dust.
Exactly. And that actually is our painting studio up there.
Uh-huh.
So that makes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, if we count the woodworking area, the stoneworking area, the metalworking area, the music area, the painting area, and then Leah's
treehouse
area, which will be her studio, I'm sure, soon. This is quite wonderful. Well, sure. Bozo and Margaret, I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to be here and see this wonderful group of facilities and to be able to talk with you and learn more about what it is that inspires you. And thank you very much, both of you, Bozo.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Ears on Art on Public Radio KCBX in San Luis Obispo.
During last month's conversation, Margaret talked about her difficulty with defining herself as an artist, due in part to how people often respond to this title. It got us thinking, so we decided to ask a few others how they define their creative selves, and for that matter, their comfort level with calling themselves artists. Before we hear from them, we revisit Margaret's comments on the subject.
Sure, I think partly a sense of good humility of just knowing that there's so many fantastic people in the world that are doing so much. And then I think it's also a part of what people project onto you when you say you're an artist. I have so many people that as soon as I tell them that, they tell me how they can't draw. And I think, they don't say to my dentist, I can't clean teeth. I think it takes a tremendous commitment to being an artist.
Hi, my name is Burl Reichenberg, and I've been an artist for a good many years, maybe 30 years, working in this community as well as other communities. At first, I had trouble calling myself an artist because it was hard to define what I was doing, except that I was creating something that was visually interesting or visually pleasing. As I've developed and as I've been doing art for a good many years, I find that it's easier to call myself an artist, and I think partly that's because partly it happened when I found my voice as an artist. I started out in ceramics, then moved on to handmade paper vessels and bowls, and now I'm doing some photography. And in each of these medium, once I found an individuality, a sense of my own voice in terms of what I wanted to say and what I wanted to create as an artist, it became increasingly easy for me to call myself an artist.
Hello, I'm Bill Beeson. I was a very precocious reader as a child, and among many things, I read plays by J.M. Barrie, Noel Coward, and John Galsworthy. Think about that unlikely threesome for a minute. Not quite what you'd thrust upon your 8-year-old, right? Forget it. I love them. I told everybody in Pittsburgh, PA, which is where we were living then, that I was going to be a playwright just like those guys. And in third grade, I wrote a play called The Queen's Necklace, which was a real mixed bag. It had stolen jewels, intrigue in high places, and love affairs, upon which I'd become a blooming authority thanks to Mr. Coward. So in the beginning, I called myself a playwright, but it took me a long time to actually become a playwright. But I took Mr. Coward's advice early on and learned everything I could about theater. I acted, I learned how to build scenery and sew costumes. I could design lighting if I had to. Throughout this long apprenticeship, I wrote plays. And by the time I had it within me to actually write something fairly decent, I didn't want to be a playwright anymore. I wanted to be a real writer, a writer who could write anything. So when I got out of college, I tried to get into advertising and couldn't. Eventually, I found a job with United Fund writing radio TV copy. And then I edited an employee newspaper for a huge supermarket chain. Finally, I got into advertising. I was a copy cub. I made 55 bucks a week, and I learned how to extol the unique promise of everything, from terrazzo flooring to Tootsie Rolls. I have never worked longer or harder in my life, nor have I ever learned as much as fast. Making people want things is a difficult business, and I got very good at it. My theatrical background was an asset, too. I could write radio and television commercials because I'd learned how to write dialogue. And about 5 years later, I had a coronary, and I decided to get into a less demanding line of work. I got a job promoting TV Guide, and then U.S. News and World Report. In between, I wrote subscription brochures for repertory theaters and promotion pieces for art galleries and arts councils. Now I often write critical pieces and pieces about the arts in general. I have written memoirs, short stories, mysteries. I am now in the throes of writing a novel. So yes, I'm a writer. As far as I'm concerned, it is almost the most fun you can have. Every once in a while, somebody will call me up or write me a letter and tell me they liked what I wrote. And you know something? I'd pay them in gold if I had it.
Hi, I'm Sandra Nichols. I first realized I was an artist about age 8. I did a chalk drawing at school on the big blackboard at the back of the room. It was a double miracle. Here was something I absolutely loved doing. And the other rambunctious third graders must have felt something special was going on, too, because not one of them went out of their way to mark it up. What told me right away that I was an artist was this great feeling. I later realized it's what the psychologists call flow. I was so engaged in the making of that chalk drawing that I lost all track of time. Now, of course, my artistic media changed over the years, and lots of things occasionally made me doubt being an artist. But that glorious feeling always came back to confirm it. Whether I was making gold jewelry, or designing textiles, or teaching creativity, or even making bread, not being aware of time in a culture that's really consumed with hurry sickness confirms that I am making art. Now, it might be dangerous to talk about food as art, but I have to tell you, I found one of my favorite art expressions on a chocolate wrapper. Life is a work of art designed by the one who lives it. Even though I've done professional marketing for 30 years, I first realized only about 10 years ago that my best art is helping other artists sell their work. I'm just passionate about empowering living artists to earn a living. Now, this art usually takes the form of creating dozens of ways to see this artist's work that neither of us would have come up with on our own. And that wonderful aha moment comes every time I'm working with an artist. Two things happen. I get that old familiar sense of timeless flow, and I also get to see the lights go on behind their eyes as they see the possibilities for the practical side of selling their work without selling their souls. What a gift to both of us. I find this work, actually this art, to be totally irresistible.
Hi, I'm Joanne Boley Ruggles, and I am an artist. It's interesting, but as far back as I can remember, perhaps even in kindergarten, I always wanted to be an artist. When people asked, you know, what do you want to do? That was what I told them. I think when I remember my childhood, my grade school years and junior high, I was always working on becoming an artist. And it's interesting. I think most people assume that artists are born. I know my mother and father probably do or did. My mom often will say to people that she's quite astonished that she produced an artist, usually with a facial expression of surprise, saying that she can't even draw a straight line. The interesting thing is that I think that presumes that artists are born, that somehow they're, you know, hatched out of the womb as fully developed artists. And I think although there may be some tendencies or interests toward the arts or interest in the arts, I think what typically happens is a young child gets some kind of gratification, some kind of notice for an artistic endeavor, likes the feeling of being praised, and moves on to, you know, to work on getting more praise. And I certainly think that's what happened with me. What's really important to recognize or to emphasize is that, you know, to be a successful artist, to be a competent artist, you have to put endless hours in learning how to use the various tools, learning how to use the materials, developing your expertise at techniques. I think that's the bottom line. It just takes a tremendous amount of time to make it look effortless.
Well, Stephen, what do you think about all of this?
I have been called many things in my life. Among these are waiter, maitre d', restaurant manager, baker and pastry chef. I've been a business owner, a jeweler, and now I can add radio program host to the list. But the moniker I most aspired to was to be called an artist. I have now dedicated myself to that goal, and although I have always dabbled in the visual arts, pursuing creative expression has at long last become the focus of my life. And, as my father said when I informed him of my new focus, it's about time. I now refer to my profession as artist. What do you think?
Well, that's not an easy one to follow. I think I'm a little bit more in the hesitancy camp as Margaret is in terms of claiming the title. I know in my soul I'm an artist, and somehow I tend to say out loud, I'm a silversmith and a sculptor, but inside it's different. I just wait for people to put that title on me. I think maybe it's time I started claiming it myself. This is a topic filled with subjectivity, and thus food for much continued thought. A good place to start might be over the dinner table. We want to thank our guests today, Margaret and Bozzo Coroscelli, Burl Reichenberg, Bill Beeson, Sandra Nichols, and Joanne Ruggles. You've been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at KCBX Public Radio for San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties. This is Chrissy Hewitt.
And this is Stephen DeLuque.
Thanks for listening.